So in this suffering and deliverance sermon, we're talking now about the various people and ways and people that God delivered and the various ways that he has done so and the lessons that we can learn through those. And we're down to the fourth one, which is Sodom and Gomorrah, which most people remember Sodom and Gomorrah for the terrible judgment that the Lord wrought on them when he rained fire and brimstone down on them. But before that happened, they were delivered, not for their own righteousness' sake, but for the sake of a man named Lot that lived among them. If you turn back to Genesis chapter 13, we'll start off looking at how this whole situation began, and that was when Abraham and Lot were sojourning together in the land. They both had a lot of cattle, and there was just too much for the same piece of land that they were inhabiting, so they decided to part ways. And Abraham, being the better man, gave Lot his choice of the land before him. And Lot decided that he would go to the well-watered plains there where Sodom and Gomorrah were. And we'll read about that in Genesis 13, 8 through 13. This is how Lot ended up in that dreadful place. Genesis 13, 8 through 13. So then Abraham said unto Lot, or Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Let me just say, just to make a little comment here, this is the way that political disagreements should be settled. If you have two people that are living in the same land that are having a hard time getting along with each other, separate. You go your way, I'll go my way. And if I might say, I think that's what this country needs. We need a separation. You go your way, we'll go our way, maybe many separations. There's no reason to be at each other's throats all the time and be yoked together with people that we don't agree with at all. I think a secession would be in order. But anyway, let's get back to this. In verse 10, and Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. So Sodom and Gomorrah was not always just covered in the remnants of fire and brimstone, covered in, you know, all this salty material. This place was like the Garden of Eden at one point. And that's why Lot decided to go there, because there was some good gains to be had there. This was a prosperous place to live. Verse 11, then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves one from the other. And Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Lot went east. Going east is symbolic of going away from God, and you see that in numerous places in the Scripture. Lot chose the well-watered plains. He chose the prosperous land. But, there's always that but, the people of that land were sinners exceedingly. It would be like when there was a large exodus large immigration into California for years, because California was a great place to live, and there is a lot. It's the land of opportunity there, and it's beautiful, and the scenery is amazing, and the weather's great. But there are sinners exceedingly that live there. It's the same thing today. You'd be a fool to go live in Silicon Valley or live in San Francisco or some place like that where all the sinners are, where judgment is certainly going to strike someday, I would think. But this is what Lot did, because he was a carnal Christian. Well, then Sodom and Gomorrah, this place where he lived, they eventually end up going to war with some of the nations around them who had previously subjugated them. So these nations had conquered Sodom and Gomorrah, and Sodom and Gomorrah served them. The king of Sodom served this other king that had conquered him for quite some while, a number of years, 12 years, it says there in Genesis 14:4. But they decided they had enough, and they were going to rebel. and it didn't turn out so well for them. In verses 8 through 11 of Genesis 14, it says, "And there went out of the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings with five. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed." So Lot ends up being collateral damage in this deal here when they try to rebel and break the yoke of the king that had them in subjugation. But they ended up falling, and now all of Sodom's goods are spoiled, and Lot and his family are taken captive. We saw that there in verse 12. Now Lot was a just man, believe it or not. If you know anything about the history of Lot, you might question this fact. But if you look in 2 Peter 2, 7 through 8, despite all of his shortcomings, despite the fact that he was willing to give his own daughters to a bunch of sodomites instead of some house guests that he had, Lot was nevertheless a just and righteous man. He was saved by the grace of God. 2 Peter 2, 7 through 8. Let's just catch the verse 6 to get the more of the sentence. "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that should, or that after should live ungodly, and delivered just Lot." Now that's just in the sense of righteous, not just in the sense of only. "Delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man, dwelling among them, in seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds." Now you might ask, why not just move? If you're living among wicked people that are vexing your righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful words and acts, why not just move? Well, because Lot was making good money there. He was enjoying himself. He was living in a nice land. You know, most people are a lot more interested in their material comforts than they are living among godlier people. So they'll stay in California rather than moving, for instance. But Lot ended up paying for this. I mean, he ended up being a man that was not much of a man of influence, but we might talk about that in the next section. So when Abraham heard that Lot, his nephew, was taken captive, Abraham got his 318 trained servants, and he went to battle with these nations that had captured Sodom and Gomorrah. Now this is really something here, if you think about it. This is in Genesis chapter 14, 13 through 16. Here Abraham is, he's just a man, he's just a guy, and he's a wealthy guy because he has 318 servants. That's 318 more than any of us have. You know, he's doing pretty well. But he takes his own servants, and they're obviously armed, and they're obviously trained. He didn't put them through basic training and then send them out. Obviously, they were ready to fight. And he delivers Sodom and Gomorrah, these whole cities, and his nephew Lot, out of the hand of these kings that had taken them captive, which is really quite amazing. Abraham was quite a military strategist. He was a general, essentially. When you read about this, he separated them out and you know, flanked them, and it's really interesting. But anyway, Genesis 14, 13 through 16 says, "And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abraham." So he had some people there that had made a league with him. "And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, so he splits up, hits them on both sides, he and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. That's pretty amazing. You think about it. Abraham did that, so he clearly was practiced. He had weapons. He knew how to use them. And I think we ought to take example from him. I think every man ought to have a battle weapon. Every man ought to know how to use it, be ready to use it, because there might come a day when you need it. So there are some lessons that we can learn from this, aside from the one I just told you, which is not even part of that. Number one, God will sometimes deliver a wicked nation for the sake of a righteous man among them. We know that Sodom and Gomorrah was a wicked nation, right? Everybody knows that. But yet God delivered them essentially as a byproduct of delivering Lot. Lot needed to be delivered, and in order to deliver Lot, the whole nation ended up needing to be delivered. So they weren't delivered for their own righteousness' sake, but for the sake of one righteous man among them. So remember that you could be that righteous person for whose sake the Lord could deliver this wicked nation. He might just deliver a town or a city or a state or a nation for the sake of a righteous person within it. Number three, or number two, depending on how you're counting them. God sometimes decides to deliver his disobedient children from trouble. This was Lot. Lot was a disobedient child of God, and God nevertheless decided to deliver him. And he probably delivered him for Abraham's sake. So here you have Lot being delivered for Abraham's sake because Abraham loved Lot and he didn't want to see something happen to Lot. And Sodom and Gomorrah gets delivered for Lot's sake. So you got two different levels here. You got one truly righteous man that ends up delivering another lousy guy that, you know, is one of God's elect, but he's a pitiful example of one. And then a bunch of other wicked, vile sinners end up coming along for the ride. That can happen. But God does not always do so. God doesn't always deliver his disobedient children from trouble. So we never want to presume on the mercy of God. Look at Romans 3 and verse 8. Romans 3 and verse 8. Paul says, "And not rather as we be slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come, whose damnation is just." You never want to start thinking and think, well, you know, Lot was a disobedient child of God. Lot wasn't much of a Christian. Lot, you know, just kind of lived life however he wanted to. Didn't really care about what God said. And the Lord delivered him, so therefore the Lord will deliver me too. I can just live however I want. I can just be a lousy Christian and God will take care of me too. Not necessarily. It doesn't always happen that way. Lot was blessed, and I think mainly because of his association with Abraham. So you don't ever want to go there. Don't assume because God had mercy on some pathetic guy that he'll have mercy on you if you act the same way. Now the next example is Lot. But this is a different time in Lot's life. So this is really the second time that Lot was delivered. So we learned already about Sodom and Gomorrah being delivered from their oppressors by Abraham. But after they did that, they continued in their wicked ways. And this is pretty much what wicked people do. When they are delivered, and I'll talk about that in just a second, it doesn't change them. It doesn't help them at all. They just continued on in their wickedness. Genesis 18, 20 through 22. So this is after they've already been restored back to their land. They got all their goods back and all that, all those things. And Genesis 18 and verse 20, the Lord had appeared to Abraham. And then the Lord decides that he's going to go check out Sodom and Gomorrah because there had been a cry come up to him about how wicked Sodom and Gomorrah was. And the Lord was going to go experience it firsthand and see if it was so. Verse 20, "And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which is come unto me. And if not, I will know. And the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. So he's going to go down and see if it's indeed as bad as he heard that it is. And that's exactly what he ended up finding out, and we'll see that in just a second. But this is an example of the wicked being shown mercy from God, as they were earlier, and yet they don't repent. They don't learn righteousness. Look at Isaiah 26 and verse 10. This is so often the case. How many times do people in this world experience some great deliverance that they don't deserve, and you'd think it would change them, and they would come out of it a new person and amend their ways, but they don't. They just do the same thing they've always done. Isaiah 26 and verse 10 says, "Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of the Lord." You know, I think of Pharaoh. How many times did God have mercy on Pharaoh? Like 10? All those plagues, at the end of every plague until the last one, Pharaoh finally caved in. Pharaoh finally says, okay, I'll let him go. I'm sorry, I messed up. And the Lord has mercy on him. And what's he do? Hardens his heart. Right? All the favor showed to Pharaoh didn't change him one bit. That's because the nature of sinners can't be changed. God is the only one that can change that. But without the grace of God working in that person's life and changing that heart, the heart just stays deceitful and desperately wicked. Won't change. That's why it doesn't even make sense. Like, if you have some horrible criminal and then you think, well, you know, he did have a bad childhood. Well, you know, he probably had this reason or that reason. Blah, blah, blah. Maybe we could just have mercy on him this once. No, don't have mercy on him this once. If he did something that is worthy of death, he needs the death penalty, because you know what? If you're merciful on him, you know what he's going to do? He's going to do the same thing over again. Now, Abraham bargained with God, and he got God to agree to spare those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah if there was only 10 righteous among them. Now, I'm not going to read the passage because we've read it not that long ago here, within maybe a week or two or three ago. But you'll remember that Abraham asked if God would destroy the righteous with the wicked. And Abraham said, well, what if there's 50? And God said, I won't destroy it for 50. He's like, well, what if there's 45? I won't destroy it for 45. He said, what about 40, 30, 20, 10? He got them the whole way down to 10. And the Lord says each time, I will not destroy it. And the last time he says, I won't destroy it for 10's sake. So if there could have been just 10 righteous people in those cities, the Lord would have saved it. But the Lord ended up destroying it. So we know that there weren't even 10 among them. And we know Lot was at least one just man, so there weren't even 9 in Sodom and Gomorrah outside of Lot. Look in Genesis 19, verses 24 through 25. It says, then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. So there's a proof of the Trinity right there. The Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. The Lord rains it from the Lord. Right, so there's two persons of the Trinity there. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. So there weren't 10, there weren't even 9. Might not have been any. Lot might have been the only righteous one. We don't really know. Now, Lot was a righteous man who made poor decisions, and he was vexed by the filthy communication of the wicked that he lived near. I think we just read this passage there in 2 Peter 2, 7 through 8. I'll just turn back there again and make sure I don't have something else to say about that. 2 Peter 2, 7 through 8. This passage is referring to what I'm talking about here with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them, in seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. So Lot made poor decisions and was vexed by it. Lot's initial decision to move to that place was a bad one. And the decisions that he made from that point to stay there were bad decisions. I like the saying, and it's true, that your life is the sum total of the decisions that you've made. If your life is screwed up, you know why it's screwed up, more than likely? It's because of the decisions that you've made. Some things happen to us and we have no control over it, right? Health calamities and things like that. But most of the time, people's lives that are a mess for one reason. Because they decided to make it that way. That's why. And that's what happened with Lot. Now, God delivered Lot and his wife and his two daughters. Look at Genesis 19, 15 through 16. Genesis 19, 15 through 16. It says, and when the morning arose, then the angels hastened Lot, saying, arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. So the Lord delivers Lot and two of his daughters. But that wasn't Lot's whole family and his wife, although his wife didn't really make it the whole way out. She only made it part way out. She looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. So really only three of them ended up being delivered, and Lot had a lot more family members than that. Now, this is a case of only the righteous and those around him being delivered from destruction and not the whole community or the nation as a whole. The Lord did not save Sodom and Gomorrah that time. As a matter of fact, the Lord didn't even save Lot's entire house that time. He saved Lot and he saved a couple along with him. Now, there are some lessons that we can learn from this. You see, God delivered Lot's other daughters. He would have delivered Lot's other daughters and sons-in-law if they had heeded his warning. Look at Genesis 19, 12 through 14. So we're going to go back in the story just a little bit here. It says, and the men said unto Lot, hast thou here any besides son-in-law and thy sons and thy daughters and whatsoever thou hast in the city? Bring them out of this place, for I will destroy this place, because the cry of them is waxing great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. So he had a bunch of other family there. The angel said, if he had daughters, thy daughters, and didn't he say thy sons? I thought he said thy sons. Where did he say that?
Verse 12.
Son-in-law, thy sons, there we go. I was looking right at it, I couldn't see it. So he had sons, daughters, sons-in-law. So there was a number of other people in Lot's house that God would have saved if they would have heeded the warning. But the sons-in-law looked at him as one that mocked. This shows you what an ineffective and pathetic man Lot was. He was an ineffective and pathetic father. When he goes in there and says, get up, the Lord's going to destroy this place. And they're like, oh, come on, Dad. You're always talking about this conspiracy crap. We don't believe it. Whatever. You know, you've been saying this for years or whatever. I don't know what they said, but they thought he was one that mocked. They did not take the man seriously because he did not deserve to be taken seriously. And they died for it. Now, here's your lesson. Failure to heed God's warnings, which he gives through his messengers, can result in destruction. Failure to heed God's warnings, which he gives through his messengers, can lead to destruction. Now, his messengers in those days, he sent angels to Lot, and then Lot was his messenger to Lot's family members. The prophets were messengers sent from God. Jesus Christ was a messenger. The apostles were messengers. People that fail to heed those warnings are flirting with destruction. And then in these last days, God hath manifested his word through preaching. Preachers are God's messengers. And if you fail to heed your pastor's warnings, it could end up in your demise. Now, if I'm giving you me thinks, and if I'm telling you my opinion about something, you don't have to heed that. You might want to consider it, but you don't have to heed that. But when I give you book, chapter, and verse, and I exhort you and admonish you and reprove and rebuke and those kind of things from the Bible, and I tell you something that the Bible says, that God says, and you just blow it off and brush it off and think, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to do whatever I want. Think of Lot's sons-in-law and his other daughters. Lesson number two. God may deliver one of your family members, but not you, if you disregard his admonitions. The whole family didn't get saved, remember? Two of Lot's daughters, the virgins, did. They listened, and they came along. The other daughters, and the sons-in-laws, and the sons, they didn't pay any attention. So it wasn't as if the whole family gets delivered here. It was the members of the family that paid attention and that obeyed the admonition. They were the ones that were delivered and saved from destruction. Lesson number three. Don't assume that you will be delivered from calamity just because your family member, like your husband or your wife or your father or your mother or so on, is obedient to God, or somewhat obedient in the case of Lot. You don't ever want to say, well, you know, my husband is a godly man, and therefore the Lord is going to deliver me because he's such a good guy, like Lot, supposedly, or like Abraham. Or don't think, my wife is such a godly Christian woman, she prays all the time, and the Lord will deliver me because my wife is such a wonderful woman. Well, he might not. He may snuff you out and save her, or he may snuff him out and say whatever, you know what I mean. He may save a husband and not a wife, or a wife and not a husband. You never know. The important thing is, heed the warnings that God gives in His Word and from the pulpit when they're coming from His Word. And then you can be assured that you will be saved. Now, secondly, the Lord was merciful to Lot and dragged him out of the city before he was destroyed. We read that in verses 15 and 16. Lot, I mean, talk about a pathetic guy. They tell him, we're going to destroy this place. The angels from God are saying, get out of this place. It's going to be destroyed. You're going to die. Warn your family. And Lot's just like, oh, I got to get my suitcase packed up. Oh, I don't want to forget my laptop. You know, oh, I can't go out without my cell phone or what. He's just lingering. He's like, oh, I better take care of some of the stuff around the house, you know, because when fire and brimstone falls, I want everything to be just so-so. Who knows why he was lingering? I'm just making stuff up. But the point is, he didn't go right away. And the Lord, being merciful, it says, literally took him by the hand and dragged him and his two daughters out of that city. That's pretty amazing. That's a testament to the long-suffering of God. Because I'll tell you what, I'm not nearly as patient as God is. And I think I'd have been like, you know what? I told you, that's it. Just send a fire and brimstone down. You're too dumb to listen. When I flat out told you to get out, you know what? You can just burn. But the Lord is a lot more merciful than that, thankfully. But here's your lesson. God is not always so merciful. So don't assume that if you delay or fail to obey, that God will miraculously save you. Don't just assume that if you delay to obey, or if you flat out fail to obey, that God is still going to save me just like He did Lot. The Lord, you know what, I'm just going to kind of wait. I'm just going to do what I want to do. I'm just, you know, I know. Yeah, I know what the preacher preaches. I know what the Bible says. But I'm just going to keep living how I want to live. I'm going to keep doing what I want to do. And I'm sure that if God's really mad about it, He'll just grab me by the hand like He did Lot. And He'll jerk me out of this situation before the fire falls. Right? Before anything really bad happens, surely God will just intervene and just take me out of the situation. And then I'll know for sure that God really didn't want me to do that. He might not. He didn't do it with the sons-in-laws. He didn't do it with the other daughters. He didn't do it with the other sons. And He might not do it for you either. You know, Jonah delayed to obey, and he got in a whale's belly. And he did live, but that was a pretty severe judgment, wasn't it? Israel failed to obey many times. You know what happened to them? They were destroyed. They were carried captive into Babylon. They were carried captive into all nations in 70 AD. They suffered for it. So don't just think that, you know, God is just going to be infinitely patient and just wait and wait and wait and then maybe just miraculously deliver you. Well, He might not. He that is often reproved and hardeneth his neck shall suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. We're told in Proverbs 29 and verse 1, I think it is. Don't presume on the mercy of God. Lesson number 3. God rewards those that diligently seek Him. So if you want assurance that God's deliverance, if you want assurance of God's deliverance, you should serve God fervently. You remember Hebrews 11 and verse 6. It says that he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. It says with Hebrews 11, 6, but without faith it is impossible to please Him, for he that cometh to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. Now, if you diligently seek God and you obey God, and when you see a verse that tells you to do something, or you hear a sermon preached that says that what you ought to do, and you do it, and you diligently seek God, you have the assurance that God is with you, that God is pleased, and He's going to take care of you. But if you disregard, you don't have that assurance, and don't be thinking you're going to be a lot. You might be in a lot of trouble, but you're not going to be a lot if you catch the play on words. All right, let's look at the next guy. This will be the last one we're going to look at today. Remember, I sent you 2 weeks' worth of outline, so we're not going to be going over 6 pages or anything today. The next one is Jacob. Now, Jacob was delivered 2 different times in his life. We're going to look at both of those. First of all, Jacob was delivered from Esau, his twin brother. If you remember, Jacob was quite the sly guy, wasn't he? He ended up... screwing Esau out of his birthright. That's not really what I wanted to say. But he ended up cheating Esau out of his birthright, catching Esau in a moment of weakness. And of course, Esau was, well, he's Esau. He's a child of wrath. So he didn't really care all that much about his birthright anyway. But Esau was really hungry one day coming back from the field. And Esau had the birthright because he was born first, only by probably minutes or something, but he was born first, and Jacob wanted that birthright. Esau was a hunter. Jacob was a mama's boy. Esau's out there hunting and working in the field. Esau's back making dinner. And Jacob's back making dinner. And kind of had the roles reversed, didn't they? And Jacob did anyway. So anyway, Esau comes back, and he's so hungry, and he says there in verse 29, Genesis 25, 29, says, and Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom, because Edom means red. So he was so hungry, he wanted that red pottage that he ended up being called red. And Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. And Esau said, behold, I am at the point of death. And he didn't say that. I am at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me? Now let me ask you a question. Do you think he was really at the point to die? I mean, chances are, if he's out in the field, do you think he would have really been out in the field for weeks on end where he comes back and he's 60 pounds, you know, he's nothing but skin and bones, and he's just within one breath of death? I mean, do you really think he's at the point to die? Of course not. He may feel like it. He's hungry, but he's being a little bit dramatic, isn't he? What good's this birthright going to do me if I'm dead, he thinks. Verse 33, and Jacob said, swear to me this day, and he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And this whole thing is just so ridiculous on Esau's part. Esau is a man's man. He's out there working in the field. I mean, wouldn't you think if your little brother wouldn't give you some food, you just beat him up and take it instead of selling your birthright? I mean, come on, think about it. But I mean, if wicked people could think, I mean, if I could think about it, certainly Esau, the prototypical man of, you know, of reprobation could think of it, but he'd rather just sell his birthright and save himself from getting in trouble from his mom because he beat up her little baby. How pathetic, huh? So Jacob swindles Esau out of his birthright. But not only the birthright, the blessing too, because they were two different things. The birthright got him a double portion, which is what the firstborn would get. But then the blessing was something else. His father was going to give this blessing to Esau as well for being the firstborn. And Jacob's mother comes up with this idea to trick Isaac into giving the blessing to Jacob. And you'll remember, I'm not going to go into great detail about this, but you remember in the deception series we talked about this. Remember how his mother comes up with this plan that she would put Esau's clothes on him, and she'd clothe him with these, you know, these hairy skins, so his skin would feel, and in the back of his neck would feel hairy, and he smelled like Esau coming out of the field. And Isaac was deceived. Isaac could hear the voice, and he knew it sounded like Jacob, but it smelled like Esau. And he made him, his mother made him the savory meat that he liked, and it seemed like the meat that Esau would have made. And so he did his best to figure it out, but he was deceived because of his failing senses and because he didn't get a second opinion, didn't ask somebody else to come in there and verify that this guy was actually Esau. But anyway, Jacob ends up stealing the blessing. And in verse 35, we'll just sum it up here. And he said, this is Isaac speaking to Esau, and he said, "Thy brother came with subtlety and hath taken away thy blessing." So Jacob stole the birthright and the blessing from Esau. And Esau hated him for it and vowed to kill him. He was, you know, justifiably upset. You wouldn't want to kill him, but he would have had a right to be upset because Jacob used subtlety and craft and stole what was rightfully Esau's. And, you know, well, let's just look at verse 41 first of all. Verse 41, "And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, 'The days of mourning my father are at hand, then I will slay my brother Jacob.'" So he's going to wait, apparently wait until his dad was dead and the mourning was over, and then he's going to kill Jacob. And he is a mighty hunter, so he could have done it. And Jacob's a mama's boy, so he was afraid, and Jacob fled for his life. And he was away for many years before he decided to go back to his homeland, at least, or more than 14, because he went over to his uncle Laban's place, and he ends up working for 14 years for Leah and Rachel, and then has a bunch of kids with them, and then comes back. So I don't know how many years, but it was more than 14 anyway. And after all that time, the Lord had told him to go back. And the Lord had told him, promised he was going to prosper him when he went back. So Jacob obeyed the word of the Lord and went back. But Jacob was afraid. He was afraid to go back because Esau is ready to kill him, even after all those years. So Jacob sends messengers to Esau telling him that he was coming back and seeking grace in his sight. This is a good idea, especially when you are in a position of weakness. Genesis 32, 3 through 5. "And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, 'Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau. Thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have journeyed with Laban, and stayed there until now. And I have oxen and asses, flocks and men servants and women servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight.'" This is called humbling yourself, because Esau is clearly a man more powerful than Jacob. And Jacob believes that his life's in jeopardy. And Jacob doesn't have a fighting chance. He doesn't think anyway. So what do? Humble yourself and seek mercy. Now, he was told that Esau was coming to meet him with 400 men, which made him a little bit afraid. Verses 6 and 7. "And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee with 400 men with him.' Then was Jacob greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two bands." Now, chances are, if you hear your brother's coming to meet you with 400 men, you don't think it's probably a welcoming party, right? More than likely, he's not happy, and he's probably coming out to slay you. And this is what Jacob thought, and Jacob was quite afraid. And Jacob made preparations to protect his family from Esau. We read there in the second half of that verse that he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands. Not a bad idea, because at least when you divide into two bands, you stand a chance of only losing half of everything you have instead of the whole thing. So that's a pretty good plan, really. And then Jacob prays to God for deliverance from Esau, and he reminds God of his promises, and this is really important. Genesis 9-12. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saidst unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. So this is why Jacob's going back, because the Lord has told him to go back. He's obeying the word of the Lord. And then he says one of my favorite verses in the entire Bible. He says, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. And I agree, I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and all the truth that God has showed unto me. The minute that you think you are worthy of the least, let alone all of it, the minute you think you're worthy of the mercies that God's shown to you, you're not worthy. The minute that you think you're worthy of the truth that God's shown to you, you will be brought down, because God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. You always want to maintain that attitude that I am not worthy of the least. I don't deserve to know anything that I know. I don't deserve to know any of the truth that I know from the Bible. I don't deserve any of the mercies that God has given me. None of it. Jacob says, for with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I'm become two bands. You know what he's saying? When he went to Laban's place, he took with him a staff. He had a stick to walk with. That was it. That was all he had. He comes back now with two bands of people and animals and wealth, wives and children. He's got all these things. And he recognizes it was all the mercy of God. Verse 12, and thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. The Lord had promised Abraham that same thing. He promised Isaac and Jacob that he'd make his seed as multitudinous as the sand of the sea. And Jacob is reminding God of his promise. Because Jacob was a believer. Despite his flaws, Jacob believed God. Because if God promised to make his descendants as many as the sand of the seashore, how's that going to happen if Esau massacres us all? So Jacob's saying, you know what, Lord, I believe what you said. I'm going to do it, but I need your mercy. You've got to make this happen. Somehow you've got to protect me, because you did say, just remember that, Lord, you said you're going to take care of me. You're going to make my descendants a great number. Well, when Jacob met Esau, the Lord softened Esau's heart, and he received Jacob in peace. Genesis 33:1-3. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men, and he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. Remember, they each had a handmaid, so they were Jacob's concubines. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. He divided them in order of importance to him. He puts the least important ones in the front, and the most important ones in the back. The handmaids, the concubines, they're expendable. Their kids, well, you know, not too worried about them. Leah, yeah, I like her all right. She's tender-eyed. But Rachel, she's the one I really like. She's the one I worked 14 years for. Put her in the back with his two favorite kids. Or no, one favorite kid. She had Benjamin later with Joseph. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. This is called humbling yourself. A lot of people don't like to do that. That's why they end up destroyed, because they won't humble themselves. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, Whose are those with thee? And he said, The children which God hath graciously given thy servant. So the Lord clearly softens Esau's heart. And we know from Romans chapter 9 that Esau was a reprobate that God hated. And yet, this reprobate that's hated of God, God softens his heart to where he has mercy on Jacob, hugs him, kisses him, makes up, asks about his well-being. They're now getting along. It reminds me of Proverbs 16 and verse 7, which says, When a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. Jacob's ways pleased the Lord. The Lord made his enemy Esau at peace with him. Now there's some lessons that we can learn from this. Lesson number one. Do what God tells us to do, even when it looks like danger might lie ahead. Because God had told Jacob, go back. And Jacob knew that Esau was back there. Jacob knew that Esau likely had not forgotten about what he had done to him and that he still had vengeance in his heart towards him. But yet Jacob was willing to go back even though he was doing it in the face of danger. So let's bring this to our own modern time. Meet for church even if the cops might show up. Who cares if they show up? Let them show up. We meet for church even if there is a chance that we could get in trouble for it. Lesson number two. Press on and never turn back from doing what God has commanded because of fear. You see, fear is no excuse for not doing what God said. Yeah, I know we all fear. We all get afraid. But faith is the opposite of that. Faith marches on in the face of fear. Fear makes you cower and be disobedient to God. Faith makes you walk forward even when you are afraid and obey God. Lesson number three, make preparations to limit the harm or loss that we might incur in battle. I mean, this could be if you're in literal battle or if you're in other battles. You know what? You could think of examples on your own, but make preparations to limit the loss. This is what Jacob did. He splits into two. That way, if Esau goes after one, the other one can run away. And the idea is, hopefully, that he'll just focus on the one and the others can escape. But here's just one simple example for you. If you have any, diversify your investments. If you have investments, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversify. Have some in different types of investments. That way, if one of them goes to zero, they won't all go to zero. Don't put 100% of your money in Bitcoin. Okay? That's a good way, or a potential way, to become a pauper or a billionaire. It just depends on who you're listening to. Lesson number four. Remind God of his promises and humbly ask him to deliver you according to them. This one's really important because this is what Jacob did. Jacob reminded God, he says, As thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea. He's saying, Lord, I'm doing this because you said. Remember, Lord, you said this. Remind God of what he said. Remind God that God has said, Thou wilt not suffer the soul of the righteous to famish. Lord, I'm going to continue faithfully doing what you tell me to do because remember, you said you won't allow the soul of the righteous to famish. You said, Whosoever believeth on me shall not be ashamed. I'm going to believe, Lord. I'm going to do what you said. I'm going to keep meeting for church. And you know what? If they come after me, and if the media comes after me, and if the police come after me, and they try to make me ashamed and make me look like some kind of a wacko that doesn't care if my grandmother dies because I'm going to keep meeting for church in the middle of a pandemic or whatever, Lord, you said you won't allow me to be ashamed. Hold the Lord to his word. Lesson number five. Humble ourselves when facing an enemy more powerful than ourselves and seek peace if doing so doesn't compromise obedience to God. Now, if you have to compromise, you don't seek peace. Right? If it means compromise, if it means, well, we might get in trouble. Let's just cancel church or whatever. Let's just, you know, we'll just all meet in our homes, just each family or something. It's kind of like church, whatever. No, don't do that if you have to compromise. But if you don't have to compromise, if you can do something to, you know, seek peace, then do it. Luke 14, 31 through 32. Luke 14, 31 through 32. Jesus said, "For what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first, and consulteth whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace." That's a wise thing to do. You sit down, you count the cost, and if you realize that this is a battle that you can't win, then don't fight it if you can decide not to fight it. Now, if God told you to fight the battle, you fight the battle. But if this is a if you're going to fight a battle over property taxes, for instance, and you know that I'm going to have to hire a lawyer and this is going to cost me $50,000 to try to fight this battle, you'd be a fool to do it, wouldn't you? And there's any number of other things that you could fight if you wanted to. You could fight the income tax. I don't think the income tax is constitutional. You could do that, but you might lose. Is it worth it? Is it worth it to get lawyers and go through the whole legal process? You know, count the cost. Now, the next time Jacob was delivered was much later in his life, right near the end of his life. And Jacob and his family were saved from dying in this great famine that happened really in all the world, in all the known world anyway. Like I said, near the end of Jacob's life, there was this seven-year famine that afflicted the land, Genesis 41 and verse 34. Genesis 41 and verse 34. It says, "In the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said, and the dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread." You remember this story where Pharaoh had this dream of the seven fat skinny cows eating the seven fat cows, and the seven dried and burned up ears eating the seven fat ears of corn. And Joseph interpreted this dream saying that there's going to be 7 years of plenty that were going to be outdone by the 7 years of famine afterwards. And Pharaoh put Joseph in charge of managing the whole food supply and laying up all this corn and grain during the 7 years of plenty so that there would be food to take them through the 7 years of dearth. So this, you know, but of course, you know, down there or up there in Canaan, Jacob didn't know anything about this. All he knows is that there's this terrible dearth in the land right now. And Jacob and his family ended up getting food from Egypt, and then they later ended up moving down to Egypt to be sustained there during the famine. Look at Genesis 42, 1 through 3. It says, "Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, Why do ye look one upon another? And he said, Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die." Verse 3, "And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt." And they got some. And we know the story, and I'm not going to go into that whole story there. I think you're pretty familiar with it. So they end up, well, I guess I will just briefly. So they go down there, they meet with Joseph, their brother that they'd sold into slavery, which we'll talk about later. They meet with him, and not really realizing who he is, and they get corn from him, but then he sends the money back in their sacks, and they chase him down and find the money in their sacks and so on, I know they didn't chase him down the first time. Anyway, they go back home and they get the money in the sacks, and they're scared to go back again. And then they go back again, and then he asked them if they have another brother, and they said that they did. And then he took the one of their brethren as collateral as they went back and said, "Don't come back again until you have the younger brother with you." And so they do that. They bring the younger brother there. Joseph reveals himself to them. And then he says, go back and get your father and bring him up into the land of Egypt. And he would sustain them there. And that's what ended up happening. Genesis 45, 9 through 11. It says, haste ye and go up to my father and say unto him, thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me Lord over all Egypt. Come down unto me, tarry not, and thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt be near unto me, thou and thy children and thy children's children, and thy flocks and thy herds and all that thou hast, and there will I nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy household and all that thou hast come to poverty. So Joseph makes a way to sustain his father and his entire family down in Egypt. Now, in order to experience this great deliverance, which is what it was in verse 7, Genesis 45, 7, Joseph said, God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So this is a great deliverance because they would have all died. There was no way they would have lived through another 5 years of famine. You can imagine how bad that would be. Imagine 2 years of famine. Imagine how bad it would be to go 2 years without any rain and you've got no food and you've got another five after this. This was a great deliverance. But in order to experience this great deliverance, Jacob had to first undergo tribulation. And that's often how it works. Look at Romans 5, 3 through 4. Romans 5, 3 through 4. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope. For Jacob to experience that deliverance, he first had to endure a lot of tribulation. Now, the tribulation that he had to endure was that his sons sold their brother Joseph, which was Jacob's favorite son. They sold him into Egypt because they hated him. Look at Genesis 37 and verse 3. Genesis 37 and verse 3. It says, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. Of course, his brothers hated him for this. Verse 4. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. So they came up with this idea that they would sell him into slavery. Genesis 37 and verse 28, Joseph sent Jacob out to check on his brethren who were out there tending to the flocks in the field. And when they see him coming, they say, hey, here's this dreamer, because he'd also dreamed these dreams that essentially said that his family was going to bow down and make obeisance to him. They really didn't like that. So when they see him coming, they decide they're going to kill him. Well, then Reuben decides that one of his brothers decides that let's not kill him, let's just throw him in a pit. And then when Reuben's gone, these Midianites come along, and Judah decides, well, let's just sell him. You know, that way we don't want to kill him. So make a quick buck. Verse 28, Genesis 37, 28. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. Of course, Joseph is a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was sold for 30 pieces of silver. Joseph was sold for 20. But same idea, you know, the brother that the rest of them hated, right? All the Jews hated Jesus Christ, and so on. You know, he was sold as a slave, and so on. Or for the price of a slave, anyway. Now, they made Jacob, that is, the brothers, made Jacob believe that Joseph had been killed. Verses 31 through 33 says, and they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, this have we found, know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. So Jacob had to suffer this terrible pain of thinking that Joseph was dead for years. You can imagine. Imagine any of your children, especially your favorite one. You think that he's been killed by an evil beast and eaten. And then you just have to live for the rest of your life thinking, my poor baby is dead. And he's, you know, was probably killed mercilessly by a lion or a bear or something and eaten up. And just, you'd have to live with this for the rest of your life. Verses 34 and 35. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. So you talk about tribulation, working patience and experience hope. He went through his share of tribulation. Well, Joseph ended up becoming the prime minister of Egypt and was put in charge of the food program, which he then laid up all this food, which brought them through the famine. He became the prime minister because he interpreted Pharaoh's dreams, and Pharaoh was so impressed that he says, I'm going to put you in charge, Joseph. Genesis 41:41. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And then verses 46 through 49. And Joseph was 39 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. And in the 7 plenteous years, the earth brought forth by handfuls. And he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities, the food of the field, which was round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn as the sand of the sea very much until he left numbering, for it was without number. You think about the providence of God. The Lord knew this famine was coming. He probably sent it coming, but he knew that there was a famine going to come years later. And he has Jacob's sons, Joseph's brothers, sell him into slavery, and Joseph ends up in prison for doing nothing wrong, by the way, and then ends up meeting these guys in prison, interpreting their dreams. The one gets out of prison, and then a couple of years later remembers that Joseph interpreted this dream and tells the Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, hey, bring this guy up so he can interpret my dream. Joseph interprets his dream about the 7 years of drought and the 7 years of plenty. And Pharaoh puts him in charge of it. And then God saves his people from this drought by using Joseph through this miraculous set of circumstances that were put in play years before that. Now, the providence of God is amazing. There are some lessons that we can learn from this. Number one, God will often allow us to suffer great affliction after having delivered us from trouble in the past. Remember, Jacob already had suffered a lot in the past. He had been driven from his home, kind of his own fault, but he had to go off in another land and live for many years before the Lord brought him back. And then he was scared to death to go back and thinking he's going to be killed by Esau, and the Lord delivers him from that. But then years later, he ends up suffering great affliction again, like worrying about dying of starvation and the famine. So don't think that because you endured a great trial in the past that God will never try you again in the future. He probably will. It says in Psalms, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth them out of them all. Some people think that when they go through a great fight of affliction, when they're first converted, a lot of times people go through some really hard stuff. I did. I went through some hell on earth times. And then people think, well, I went through such tribulation then that now I'm good to go. I can just kind of put it on cruise control. That's not the way it works. The Lord delivers you out of one affliction. He gives you a time of peace, and then comes another affliction. Lesson number two. The elderly, even those who are godly, are not exempt from suffering calamities in life. So if you do someday, then know that you're not alone. Because Jacob was an old man at this point. When he went before Pharaoh, when he moved in there, he said he was 130 years old. You might think, well, you know what? I've lived 130 years. I'm pretty old. I've been through a lot. Maybe the Lord will just take it easy on me. No, maybe he'll put you through a seven-year dearth. And maybe you'll have to pick up and move to a whole new place when you're old and can barely go anymore. So if that happens to you, well, just know that it's happened to others. And number three, and final, sometimes our present suffering is the means by which God will deliver us from greater suffering later. Sometimes God allows us to suffer now so that we will not suffer worse later. Jacob suffered the death, or the what he thought was the death of his son, in order to be delivered later, a greater deliverance. But he had to go through that first suffering in order to have Joseph be the one that would deliver them from starving to death years later. So sometimes, if you're suffering now, just remember that God may be allowing you to suffer now because this will prevent you from suffering greater in the future. Let me just give you an example. Let's say you're engaged to marry somebody that's a heathen unbeliever or something, and maybe you weren't even converted. Maybe you were unconverted, both of you are unconverted, you're engaged to marry a heathen, and for some reason you have some blow up and you break up. And it was just a terrible experience, and you were just heartbroken and crushed. You think, why did God allow this to happen to me? This is terrible. I feel so horrible. But you don't realize that you were in for a life of misery with this person that wouldn't have been a good person for you to marry. So you had to suffer first to be delivered later on in life. That's just one example. There could be many. So that takes care of the examples for today. Next time we will pick it up with Joseph, and we'll look at how Joseph himself was delivered. So Joseph was the sufferer and the deliverer. He suffered, which we already looked at, or he delivered. Now we're going to look at how he also suffered and was delivered himself next time.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.